We began a series within a series last 2 weeks ago from the proof of the presence. The proof of the presence in 10 mighty works, which is covering about 6.5 chapters, if not 7 chapters almost, in the book of Exodus, beginning with chapter 7, verse 8. And I don't want to insist this evening so much, though we read from verses 14 through 24, which is the first mighty work of God, the first miracle, or the first plague that God has unleashed against Egypt. And I'd rather want us to insist in the beginning, just in a few minutes, more on the fact, you know, that God is working to form a people for himself, and he is using other peoples, he's using nations, he's using situations, and God writes, creates history in doing what he is doing. This is the most important thing. This week I did meditate probably more than ever on God's work with Israel and what's the essence of that covenant. For we are often tempted to look at the old covenant as something which is imperfect, something which is not good, and we forget that it's the covenant of God, and it is perfect. The imperfection lies within man. The law of God is perfect, and even Paul says in Romans that the law is rendered impotent, he says, powerless through the flesh, because our flesh is the agency. Think about that. And all those, you know, who go on peaceful and noisy protests in favor of the freedom of the will, they forget one thing. I talked, you know, in the preliminaries with one of our brothers here when I was when we were waiting for the people to come, and we were talking about this, the freedom of the will. It would be wonderful if it was true. That the will would be indeed free. We have a free arbiter, we can call it, but the freedom of the will would be a useless thing, because the will by itself is nothing. The will by itself can do nothing. The agency through which the will is working is the human nature. And the human nature is totally depraved, is totally corrupt. That corruption, that deprivation or depravity is not deprivation, depravity. That is actually a manifestation of slavery to sin. And before someone is liberated, is freed from that, we can't even talk about a genuine free will. It's just in theory, like the theory of evolution is something that doesn't exist, it's just a theory. So it shouldn't be taught as fact or a factual reality, because it's not. And it's so when we talk about the Old Covenant, we often say, oh, the Old Covenant had this material side to it, promises of a big name, of a great many people or nation, all the prosperity in every way. Well, we shouldn't forget the other side. I use the word side. This is only one side of the covenant. There is something else in the covenant. Leaving aside, you know, that promise which started in the Proto-Evangelion in the book of Genesis, and continues through in Genesis 12 with Abraham being promised to be the blessing of many nations, of everyone. So, leaving all this aside, there is something that sounds very covenantal in the covenant. And God repeats that, not only when at the institution of the covenant, but throughout the Old Testament. You shall be my people, and I will be your God. So that is actually the focus of the covenant. The belonging. In the beginning, we couldn't speak about Israel as a people, because they were a group of peaceful, nomadic shepherds. That's what they were. They were shepherds living in the wilderness, peaceful and always trying to live in peace with the people, except, you know, when there was the big trouble of Jacob's sons, when they killed a lot of people, a lot of innocent people, and Jacob didn't want that. But they were, that's what they were. They were not a nation. And God, in His intention, He never wanted them to be a nation. As a matter of fact, in the Old Testament, the word for nation, which is goy, or goyim, nations, is never used in reference to Israel, except in the cases when God wanted to rebuke them. He uses them to refer to them as a people. My people, Ami. Ami. That's the expression. And it's throughout the Old Testament. So they are to be a people. And they became a nation when they asked for a king. The king was the unifying factor in their eyes, that will bring all the groups, the nomadic groups of Israel together, all the tribes of Israel together. This is what they were forming into what is called a nation. And yet God refuses to call them a nation. He calls them a people, my people. And a people is a wonderful community which does not necessarily function according to the rules of a nation. Because nation is of the world, and people is of God. It's Ami, it's my people. It's my people, they are not a nation. What do you call that? What name would anyone give to that nation? Well, God even named the founder of that nation Israel. You know, the man that fought with God, or the prince of God. And that's the name of that nation. So it's God's principality. It's His people. And he's the ruler of that. But these people, in the relationship, when we look from the beginning of the covenant, this statute or status of the people of God is something that's a process of becoming. And at Mount Sinai, for the first time, they have been given a law that should unify them. That should have unified them. A law according to which they had to function under God. That was the constitution. Like a country has many laws, but the essence of the law is actually captured in the constitution, which is very often not larger in size than our church directory. It's a small book. But that has references to a lot of laws in the realm, which all have to carry the essence of that, to express the essence, the, what do they call that in that Australian comedy, the vibe of the Constitution. That vibrates into all the law. And this is, the Ten Commandments are actually the essence, the Constitution of the people of Israel. And then, of course, there will be a lot of laws. And God is forming them. And in the process of forming them, of having them become His people one day, when they will be a people, He is actually teaching them at every step. And God is also seeking to convince them of His power, of His presence. I often, when I read these miracles, I have to jog my memory all the time in reading them. When I read about the miracles, the 10 plagues of Egypt, which were actually 11 because we have to call the crossing of the Red Sea as the 11th one, and we leave aside the first one, which was the rod of Aaron, which turns into Moses, which turns into a snake, and it does not swallow the snakes, the fake snakes, but in swallowing the rods of the others, we said last time, it's the power of God versus the power, the fake power of man, and the power of God cancels the powers of evil. That's what we should learn from that. But there are these 10 plagues. I have to remember, why is God writing them? Often people, especially in the charismatic circles these days, they think that the more miracles you have, the more people come to church. Well, if they come for that, let them stay home, I would say. Miracles don't save anyone. For whom were these miracles actually done? Israel was already God's people there. They were His. He said, I called you by your name. You are mine. They were His people. They didn't have to come to any kind of conversion or through any kind of conversion to come to God. They were His already. He brought them into relationship. They did not seek Him. He built them up from one man into a people. A large group of people coming from one blood. And He made them His people. So He didn't have to convince them with His power to bring them to conversion. He did not intend to convince Pharaoh and to turn him into a, to use that wrong expression, into a Christian. Turn him into a follower of Jehovah, into a Jew. No. Because it didn't work out. It did not succeed. So who are these miracles for, and what's their purpose? I would state only, we'll see when we go through this, but we are not going to do that this evening. We'll see how God is working through them. These people were the prisoners of Egypt, and their only chance, their only hope was God, was in Yahweh. On the other side was Pharaoh, who had on his side everything. He had the conscience of the people, of the nation of Egypt. He had the religious system, and he also had his own personality. The people worshipped him as a direct descendant of their supreme God. So he was a deity for them. So you have one God against another God. And also he had something that in those days was considered an invincible army. And God begins with all this step by step by step by step. And he demolishes all of these powers. And he even, as we will see through this, and I'm preaching to the converted here, but let me say that we will see how actually God, when the time comes, he hardens, he directly says that he hardens the heart of Pharaoh, that he, so God seals him under that conviction to destruction. The sentence is finally said, he is being taken any chance of return. So after the fifth miracle, he actually enters on the path of no return. One way street to destruction. And it actually, before the Exodus, before the people go out of Egypt, it culminates in the death of the firstborn of Egypt, meaning all the firstborn of Egypt. In other words, they were left without an heir. They were left without an heir, and all their system is crushed and crumbled. And the last thing that was left was the army. And that army had to be turned into a bunch of dust, a pile of dust that would be buried under the waters of the Red Sea. And the people of God emerged victorious. And then it's a different stage of their formation into a people of God, a people with a supreme leader who is not other than God, the creator of this universe, the King of Kings, and the Lord of Lords. So this is the path that we are going to follow in the future, and probably we'll have to make a choice whether we'll look at all of these miracles together and see how each of them deals with each of those aspects. For they are very important to know. They are important to know. So the first one is the plague of the waters becoming blood. People of Egypt worshipped the river Nile, and if you have some time to spend, you can go on Google and you watch, everything about Nile. From the springs of Nile and all the way down to where it goes into the sea. And you can see how wonderful that is, how great that is. And the people worshipped the Nile as a god, as a life-giving god. But also, because every god has to have sons, and demigods and all that, all the small rivers of Egypt were being considered like his children. And the people were worshipping all the waters. That's not all wrong, in the sense that water is important, and water is a life element, and it's important, but not to worship it, because it's a created thing. And they worship Nile, and the first blow that God gives to Egypt is the waters. So that is the first, if you want, foundation brick or stone of the religion of Egypt. They did not consider their life as coming from God, but from a created thing, from a river, and God turns it into blood. And not only Nile, all the rivers of Egypt, and people ran out of water, and the fake miracle workers of Pharaoh could not double that and turn some water into blood, or reverse what Moses and Aaron have done through the power of God. Or God did it through them by his power. And they can't do that. And that one should expect that Pharaoh would right away react to that, respond to that, and say, okay, go. But he does not want to do that. He is actually having to wait for Moses and Aaron to do that, so that the waters are being restored. And they do that. Well, it is only God that can do it. So why was this? And why were all the other plagues sent over Egypt? It's in order to show his people that he is with them, and to teach them and all the coming generations, including us, that salvation and true freedom comes only through God. And through God and God alone. There is no human work. And when God wants to do something and he determines to do that, no one can reverse that. And no one can hinder, can frustrate God's plan. For everything he begins, he brings to a good end. And we will look at it in the future soon. We'll look at least the important elements of all this, without having to tell you anecdotes, like one more night with the frogs. And because they were nice with lice and with everything else, because Pharaoh would never give in. He was a little bit like a kind of Klink, Commandant Klink in Hogan's Heroes, who always promises, and every time when he gets his way, he denies, he withdraws. He says, no, I don't have to do that, I won't do that. So this is how Pharaoh, this self-conceited man, so full of himself, he is acting like a comedian. It is not for a king to die, to lie and to take back his promises. The true king, the King of Kings, against whom he was fighting, He always keeps his promises. And he always does the things that he says. And he's always there for his people. We have to remember this. And this will be a great help for our daily living. I stop here so I don't dilute what I already said. And the Lord help us through this. Amen.